This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. In 1986, Richard Rhodes wrote The Making of the Atomic Bomb. He ended that book with the image of a man waking from a nightmare of nuclear holocaust. The man, a Japanese doctor who had treated survivors of Hiroshima, wrote in his diary, "I awakened short of breath and with my heart pounding." Richard Rhodes added, "So do we all." Now Richard Rhodes has a new book that takes up the story of the nuclear age in the aftermath of the bombing of Japan. It's called Dark Sun, The Making of the Hydrogen Bomb. It examines the political, social, and scientific forces that combined to push the United States not only into the arms race and the Cold War, but also towards the nuclear abyss, the creation of thermonuclear weapons thousands of times more powerful than the bombs dropped on Hiroshima or Nagasaki. In Dark Sun, Rhodes describes life at Los Alamos, the secret nuclear weapons laboratory in New Mexico, and gives insights into the complex personalities of Robert Oppenheimer and Edward Teller. Robert Oppenheimer was the scientist who led the wartime operation of Los Alamos, and Edward Teller was the Hungarian-born theoretical physicist who worked with the team of scientists at the Los Alamos lab, and who eventually became known as the father of the H-bomb. Edward Teller had the idea for the hydrogen bomb even before the Los Alamos team had completed the A-bomb. But in the aftermath of the bombing of Japan, scientists were secretly in disagreement about the moral implications of building even more destructive bombs. Richard Rhodes says that everything changed in 1949, the year the Soviet Union successfully tested its first atomic bomb.
In 1949, really, we had dawdled along developing atomic bombs, but the military, the U.S. military, had never defined a military need for a thermonuclear weapon, a hydrogen bomb. We had, however, put all of our defense stakes, as it were, in the atomic bomb basket. We had reduced our armies by enormous numbers at the end of the Second World War. Truman had reduced the defense budget from some $90 billion a year in 1945 to under $15 billion for the years after the war. We essentially had confronted the vast Soviet army that was on the ground in Europe with a nuclear alternative. When the Soviets tested an atomic bomb, which they had developed partly through espionage, it was in fact a carbon copy of our first atomic bomb, we were panicked. They had suddenly had not only this vast conventional force, but they also had nuclear weapons. And it was in that context that motion started, movement started, discussion started in Washington as to what we should do. And those who believed that bigger and better nuclear weapons were the answer, or specifically those who believed that a unique capability was the answer, a hydrogen bomb, which the Soviets presumably would not have, quickly carried the day. I found adequate evidence to indicate that President Truman didn't spend 5 minutes going through the alternatives when he decided on the hydrogen bomb.
Well, it makes me think of the quote in your book that the arms race is a hall of mirrors, that yeah. once we knew that the H-bomb could be so destructive, all we could think about was what if the enemy got there first?
That's right, indeed. And people like Edward Teller were very good. In fact, Teller has always been a master of threat inflation and was able to argue, despite all reality, that the Soviets might already have or be close to having a hydrogen bomb. This at a time when Edward Teller had no idea of how to build a workable hydrogen bomb. And indeed, his proposal, which he had been pushing all during the Second World War and afterward, for what was called the classical super, a particular design that was supposed to be a megaton yield hydrogen bomb, was proven within the next year after the decision in the end of 1949, was proven to be unworkable. So one of the things we did that was truly unfortunate was to announce to the world that we were going to build a new weapon that we didn't know how to build.
Why was Edward Teller so set on developing a bigger bomb?
I think one can say, with fairness to the historical record, that Teller saw the hydrogen bomb as the great potential achievement of his life, that Teller saw, and this is a deeper question about his personality, that Teller saw the threat from the Soviet Union in a deep and personal way. Maybe that's his Hungarian background, maybe that's simply his own psychology. There's a remarkable dialogue that goes on between Teller at that time and John Manley, who was a physicist at Los Alamos, where Teller says, if we don't build the hydrogen bomb now that the Russians have an atomic bomb, I, Edward Teller, will be a prisoner of the Russians in the United States within the next 5 years. So from his point of view, the fact that the Soviet Union had one or two atomic bombs, when we had more than 100, still didn't prevent the possibility that somehow the Soviet Union would take over the United States. There's no logic that I can see to that, but that's the way he felt. And in that context, to him, it was crucial that we somehow have a bigger and more dangerous threat in order to deter the Soviet side.
President Truman announced the H-bomb program in 1950, as you point out, when the scientists involved didn't even know how to make one. Why did he announce it so early, or why did he announce it at all? It just seemed to be a call to arms to the Soviets to start trying to make their own or to step up espionage efforts.
And indeed it was. The Soviets stepped up their hydrogen bomb development effort as a direct result of Truman's announcement. I think, as is so often the case in the history of the development of the arms race, the reason Truman announced publicly that we were going to, as he put it, continue developing a hydrogen bomb was basically for domestic political consumption. He had the problem that Congress was up in arms and somewhat hysterical, was being prodded by the Teller faction, if you will, to do something about the Soviet atomic bomb. Again, it's hard to reconstruct from this late date how panicked we felt to suddenly be in a situation where we had atomic bombs but no big conventional army, while the Soviets now had atomic bombs and a big conventional army. And Congress was just as vociferous as one can imagine in saying, we've got to do something about it. So Truman offered what looked like an easy fix, a technical fix to the problem. That was a time, if there was ever a time after 1945, when both sides might have tried once again to arrive at some mutual agreement about arms control. The Soviets had not been willing to go for international control of atomic energy in 1946 for the obvious reason that they didn't have the bomb and we did. And the very knowledge of how to do that is in itself a sort of threat. By 1949, they did have that knowledge, and we had that knowledge, and we were at a point of sort of parity, at least in that field, and might well have been able to sit down and have further discussions, which is what Enrico Fermi and the Nobel laureate American physicist Isidore Rabi proposed in 1949. But that's all just simply swept away by the record of what Truman's own advisors said he thought about the problem, which was essentially, can we build it? Then we should. And he was advised, of course, that we could.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Robert Oppenheimer in the context of this discussion. When Edward Teller and Stanislav Ulam first came up with a breakthrough plan for the H-bomb, Teller presented it to other physicists, including Oppenheimer, at a meeting in Princeton. And you write that, to a man, practically, they all reacted as if in the presence of a miracle.
That's right.
And that Robert Oppenheimer jumped onto the H-bomb bandwagon, whereas before he was against working on it, against researching it, against developing it, against it philosophically, morally, and scientifically. But you say that he quote, thought it was, he thought it was, quote unquote, too technically sweet to pass up. And I think, and again, this is Monday morning quarterbacking, but I think looking back, many of us feel as if the question of arms control, the question of the A-bomb and the hydrogen bomb were lost to science, that science was in love with its own technology.
Maybe that's going too far. I think Oppenheimer always had an ambivalent relationship with power, and I think the record of his life indicates that. He, after the war, was suddenly celebrated as the great mind who had delivered this great new weapon to America, and he savored that. He was an advisor to all sorts of organizations within the federal government in the years that followed. Certainly the leading advisor on nuclear matters to our government, and in a way to all of us, because he was an eloquent speaker and an eloquent writer as well. But he also understood that when you can do something, you probably will do something, or your enemy will do something. He said something once that I find one of the most clear and remarkable statements about science I've ever read. He said, "The deep things in science are not found because they are useful. They're found because it's possible to find them." And when it became possible to build a hydrogen bomb, it was clear to him that someone would, and that we best had as well, and then could try once again to decide whether and how we wanted to deploy this device. So without denigrating his complex relationship with power, I think he was accepting what was essentially a fait accompli. There was now a way that was clear to do this thing, and so we probably would need to go ahead and check it out.
Richard Rhodes is my guest. He won the Pulitzer Prize, among other awards, for his book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb. He's continued the story with his new book, Dark Sun, The Making of the Hydrogen Bomb. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Richard Rhodes. His book is Dark Sun, The Making of the Hydrogen Bomb. Already in 1953, Robert Oppenheimer was pointing out the futility of stockpiling more and more nuclear weapons. Is that how he became targeted as a suspected Soviet spy?
Well, he had been approached during the Second World War, probably three times, by Soviet agents and their representatives, and asked to share, as they put it, this important information with our gallant allies, the Russians. And I think his brother Frank had also been approached, and that was a more problematic situation because Frank had been a member of the Communist Party until the beginning of the war. What's remarkable is, first of all, the FBI wiretaps that are in the record indicate that the Communist agents, speaking to each other, said we couldn't get anywhere with Oppenheimer. He told us in no uncertain terms to get the hell out. And that Oppenheimer, when asked by General Groves, who ran the Manhattan Project, who his contacts had been, convinced General Groves not to mention that Frank had been approached, and not to mention who had approached Oppenheimer. That was all in the record, and it was not very clear in the record quite what had happened, and that made it easy for those who hated Oppenheimer to find cause to believe that he might have contributed to the Soviet development. One of the things that I uncovered is a secret interview that Edward Teller gave the FBI in 1952. The FBI went to him to ask him about Oppenheimer, and he responded with some truly scurrilous charges. He said that Oppenheimer might be mentally ill or might have been mentally ill at one time. He said he's by far the farthest left of all the atomic scientists. He said that his judgments on the hydrogen bomb slowed down the development of the bomb. This at a time when Teller didn't know how to build a bomb, and Oppenheimer was essentially saying Teller's design is unworkable. When it came time to charge Oppenheimer with being a security risk in 1954, the AEC, putting together its list of charges, lifted most of the charges directly from that secret interview with Edward Teller.
Robert Oppenheimer was officially labeled in 1904 a risk to national security. What happened to him after that?
His friends say that long, painful ordeal of having his life dragged out year by year, and love affair by love affair, and bad political judgment by bad political judgment in front of the world, really changed him and destroyed him. Most immediately, what happened is his security clearance was lifted. And in a world where all the decisions are based on secret information, as is the world of nuclear weapons and nuclear strategy, if you don't have a security clearance, you're not a player. And Oppenheimer had been a player at the highest level for the last 6 or 7 years and was really, really destroyed to be cut out of that part of his life. He continued as director of the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton. He became a kind of smiling public man, but he very quickly acquired the throat cancer that would kill him and died in 1967 at 62 years of age.
Well, did we lose a mind and a personality and a leader who could have changed the direction that the arms race went?
Oh, yes, without question. Oppenheimer was really, I think, in a very deep sense, the most perspicacious of the American atomic scientists. He had learned well the lessons that Niels Bohr had brought to America in the war, of understanding that the only answer to nuclear weapons, which are a common danger to all countries, is for those countries to sit down and negotiate an open world where people couldn't continue to develop such weapons. So I think we lost something very valuable when Oppenheimer was destroyed. I would say at the same time that as a person, to know Oppenheimer more, at least in the historical record, is to like him less. He was a very cold and cruel man to people he didn't admire or respect. And a lot of his troubles were probably brought on by that personal part of the equation as much as by his political positions.
You wrote in a recent New York Times commentary that one effect of the existence of nuclear weapons was deterrence, that deterrence installed itself from the beginning for both superpowers, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, from the beginning of research and development of nuclear weapons. Do you believe, though, that all nations now still in possession of nuclear weapons have credible deterrent to war? And I ask that because deterrence only applies when a country has a stable form of government, a stable chain of command. And our greatest danger among them is that perhaps a terrorist group could get a hold of nuclear materials or atomic weapons in the Soviet Union as their weapons and their materials are apparently shabbily guarded now, and the country is unstable. And it seems that the framework for your argument about deterrence might not hold in this period.
No, in fact, to the contrary, deterrence would seem to work even without the presence of any nuclear weapons at all. I present as an example Japan. Japan, without question, is a nuclear power. It's a nuclear power because it has the plutonium with which to make nuclear weapons, and because it certainly has the knowledge of how to make nuclear weapons. But it's not a nuclear weapons state, because it has chosen not to make those weapons. But I cannot imagine any country in its right mind threatening Japan in a nuclear way, because it would take about 2 months for the Japanese to build the first Japanese atomic bomb, and they could build quite a few quickly after that. Deterrence works finally, I think. It's clear. I've been at this now for 15 years trying to understand this whole story. I think deterrence works when all is said and done at the level of the knowledge of how to do this thing, how to build these devices. I worry much less about a so-called terrorist atomic bomb than many people do for this reason. It's hard to imagine, first of all, a terrorist group assembling the technologies and the skills necessary to build what is, in fact, a very complicated device. You need a metallurgist, and you need a physicist, and you need a chemist, and you need quite a few different technologies put together in one place and some fairly elaborate machinery to do the work. And then when one thinks of the Saddam Husseins of the world, they got to where they are by, first of all, protecting their base of power. I think it's very significant that Saddam Hussein had poison gas warheads for his Scuds during the Persian Gulf War and chose not to use them on Tel Aviv, knowing, as he knew, that the Israelis would have nuked Baghdad if he had done so. Deterrence does work, even among those so-called rogue leaders that we all are being taught to fear, I think as much to keep up the defense budget as for any more rational reason.
The Senate last week was moving ahead with plans to revive a version of President Reagan's Star Wars program. And certain members of the Senate said that we need an early defense system to intercept any warheads that might be set off accidentally or deliberately from third world countries. I'd like your thoughts about that development and about business, I guess, as usual, as we look to the future of the dwindling yet still here arms race.
Well, the Strategic Defense Initiative was another one of Edward Teller's schemes, which he sold to Ronald Reagan in those days before Reagan made his announcement. As it's been scaled back, because everyone has realized slowly that it was another one of Teller's fictions, a system that he didn't know how to build that he claimed he could build. As it's been scaled back and scaled back, there has developed a bureaucratic momentum within the government to continue to support some kind of effort, and that, I think, is this, what this sort of vestigial but still outrageous decision by the Republican leadership to pursue spending some money to keep this so-called capability up. The fact is, as has been clear from the beginning, as Curtis LeMay used to say in old-fashioned terms, a few bombers will always get through, and a few warheads will always get through. And under those circumstances, as is very clear from what's happened at the end of the Cold War, the solution, as Bohr said in 1944, is a political solution, necessarily. You cannot have a military solution to weapons as small and as portable and as hugely destructive as nuclear weapons.
Richard Rhodes, thanks for talking with me on Fresh Air today.
Thank you.
Richard Rhodes' new book is called Dark Sun, The Making of the Hydrogen Bomb. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.